stories carry with them great power.
They can transport us into the light and into the dark.
And into a place in between, a land of shadows.
It is in this land where the macabre and the strange reign.
With tales of terror,
tales of hope,
tales of the whimsical,
and the weird.
These are stories told in the shadows.
And we are the Shadow Storytellers.
This tale takes place in a time and world that aren't our own, but are not as different as one might like. This world believes itself doomed, with half the population bearing a unique genetic flaw that will end their family lines within a couple generations. Their only hope lies within the bodies of the other half, who are now hunted off the street by their neighbors. There are those who seek to prevent this terrible future and protect the rights of the hunted, but only from the shadows, as the cost of being discovered is unthinkably high. Pull up a seat and listen close as we share with you tonight's tale, Sacrifice.
When the boy crossed the street in front of me, I knew exactly what was about to happen. He was dressed carefully. Too carefully. His long, loose pants concealed the height and shape of his knee joints, and he wore both a turtleneck and a hooded jacket with sleeves that hooked down over his thumbs, in spite of the warm weather. His sandy hair was grown out long over his forehead and ears. He walked with his head down, shoulders up, hands in his pockets, trying to pretend that his quick pace was nothing but the normal urgency of a teenager with too much homework to get to, and completely unrelated to the five people following purposefully behind him. "What are you hiding under all that?" a large, broad man called from the front of the group. "Hey, are you deaf? Show me!" The boy broke into a jog, but one of the smaller, faster men swept around in front to box him in. "He's murdering my great-grandbabies!" screamed a woman in her mid-40s, not much older than myself, pointing at the boy with her whole arm from the middle of the mob. "Look at him! He might as well be plunging a knife into their little hearts right there!" The faster man grabbed the boy by the upper handle of his backpack and turned him around to face the broader one. The rest of the mob gathered around to cut off more angles of escape. None of them seemed to care that they were still blocking the crosswalk. It was 4 in the afternoon, peak after school rush, but nobody honked. The cars waited patiently, and the sidewalk traffic marched on, an immeasurable blend of approving and hoping not to be noticed. A man in a baseball cap pulled the boy's hood off, and a younger woman in a tidy white blouse and knee-length skirt pulled out a few of his hairs. Moving with clinical efficiency and not looking at the boy any more than she had to, she pulled his wallet from his pocket, took out his ID card, and stowed it in a Ziploc bag with the stolen hair. Her part completed, she excused herself to a van parked along the side of the street. The fast man swept back the rest of the boy's hair so the others could check him for a widow's peak and attached earlobes. The broad man paused for a moment with apparent disappointment, but then pointed at the boy's mouth. "Smile," he ordered. "Tell me a joke," the boy retorted. He was trembling so hard that I wasn't sure how he was staying on his feet, but lacking the safe option of running away, he seemed willing to give his frustration free rein. "He's killing them," the woman shrieked. "Show me your fucking dimples," the man barked, shaking the boy. "I know you have them." "If you know," the boy sighed, "then why does it matter?" "You all heard it," the broad man turned to his companions. "He just admitted it." The boy seized his moment, pulled his hand out of his pocket, and emptied a pocket canister of mace into the fast man's face. The man screamed and reeled back, letting go of the boy's backpack. The boy bolted between slow-reacting, outstretched arms, back toward the right side of the street, where he'd started from. "He's going to get away with it!" the older of the two women cried, tears streaming down her red face in rivers as she held her shaking finger out toward him. "Murder! Murder!" "No, he's not," said the broad man, charging after him. Rather than trying to grab him, the broad man landed a wild haymaker to the side of the boy's neck, sending him rolling onto the hood of my car. The boy cried out and tentatively brought his hand to the bloody spot on his neck where the man's ring had split his skin. Now that I could see his face up close, he looked even younger than I'd guessed by his frame, 15 at most, about the same age as my son was when... well, younger than he should have been by now. He looked right at me for just a moment, his expression anything but hopeful, and I almost expected him to curl into a ball right there on the hood. Then he dragged himself over the edge, back to his feet, and kept running. I'd known what was about to happen to him from the moment I saw him. What I didn't know was whether I was going to do something about it. Not until I took my foot off the brake. Broadman, crying woman, and baseball cap were all within range of my bumper when I stomped on the gas. Baseball cap man jumped back, cursing and getting clear by inches. I caught the broadman in the hip and knocked him to the asphalt, skinning his arm. Crying woman's legs went out from under her and she ended up on my windshield, hollering and pounding on my roof as I accelerated into the intersection, and then hit the brakes to send her rolling back off again. I pulled halfway around the corner, close to the sidewalk the boy had stumbled to, and threw open my passenger door. He was staring at me, disbelieving and wary, and he wasn't the only one. The bystanders who had been so timid about noticing anything that had come before were openly watching now. I swallowed, nervously mourning my previously clean license plates, but reminded myself that I hadn't exactly been living an on-the-grid life for a while now. I pulled down my collar to show the way my clavicle joint lists noticeably to the right, then forced a joyless, dimply smile from attached earlobe to attached earlobe. 3 markers of the eternity gene. Enough to prove that I had as much to lose as the boy. With only a split second more of hesitation, he sprinted across the rest of the distance to jump into the seat beside me. I put the pedal down. Once we were free of the claustrophobic school zone, I looked away from the highway ahead long enough to check on the boy. His eyes were far off. I couldn't tell from that angle whether the pupils were equal. "How's your head?" I asked. He touched the spot at the base of his skull where the bruising from the punch had begun to spread visibly up into his hairline. "It hurts," he said shakily. "Just around the impact site or all the way through?" I asked. "I don't know," he said. "Everywhere, I guess." "Are you feeling dizzy or lightheaded?" I asked. "Any nausea? Visual or auditory distortions?" "You a doctor?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "A geneticist. I didn't used to see patients," I corrected myself. A lot of things had changed in my life since the eternity gene craze had begun. "But yes, I went to medical school," I finished. "Geneticist," he repeated, touching the door handle even though we were going at least 70 in the carpool lane. I clarified. "One who actually paid attention in ethics class." I didn't censor the bitterness in my voice, and it seemed to calm him. That and staring at my ears. Deciding that he seemed lucid enough to put off any further examination until we were stationary, I said, "There's a small lockbox in the glove compartment lined with a Faraday cage. The key is in the messenger bag on the back seat. Turn off your phone and lock it inside." Oh shit, the boy said, digging his phone out of his pocket with sudden realization. "I have to talk to my mom." I was out of practice anticipating the needs and rituals of people who weren't alone in the world. I should have known when I'd picked the kid up that he'd have family members to protect and comfort. "Are you biologically related?" I asked.
"What?"
"To your mom."
"No," said the boy. "She's my stepmom, technically, but she raised me since before I can..."
"I didn't ask about your emotional relationship," I said. "Does she have the gene markers?"
"No," he answered.
"Good," I said. "She might be okay then."
"Might?" he repeated.
"Those privateers back there got away with your DNA and your ID," I reminded him. "Within an hour, you'll be flagged in every system as a possible donation dodger. Within a week, it'll be confirmed, and they'll be splitting up the bounty for identifying you and complaining about how much more they'd have gotten for bringing you in alive. Sometime in between, the Tomorrow's Children Authority will send officers to your house looking for you and any relatives who also have the gene. But if your mom doesn't have it, she can play dumb, lean into the stepmother angle, and pretend she never noticed your markers, and she'll probably just get a fine." He tapped wildly at his screen. "I have to warn her." I really wanted to snatch the phone away. The longer he kept it on, the easier it would be for us to be tracked, headed off, surrounded. But the thought of his mother being left wondering, I couldn't stomach it any more than he could.
Make it fast, I told him. Don't tell her anything you wouldn't want the TCA to know. Anything she keeps from them past this point means hard time for her. Don't tell her where you are or where you're going. Don't tell her my name. I don't know any of those things, he said. Good, I said. But I have to tell her when I'll be home, he said. His voice turned small and high as it butted up against the reality of the situation. Just tell her you're safe, I advised, and that you'll see her again. I turned the radio on and up to drown out the sound of the call, and the tears that came afterward, and the nagging chance that I might be overpromising, and the altogether unfathomable responsibility I'd so casually invited into my car. We hid the car under a thick cover of kudzu vines a distance off from the side of the road, stripped the plates, and walked the last mile and a half to the abandoned health clinic that was now both work and home for me. I carried the groceries I'd been out for in the first place. The boy took care of the phone box and plates, along with his own backpack. He hadn't made a sound since finishing his goodbye call, except for the odd sniffle, even when I disinfected and bandaged his neck. A plane passed noisily overhead, and I tried not to think about the eyes above us, and the satellites above them, that could capture us coming and going from this supposedly empty building if the right person thought to check at the right moment. When I was in med school, I had the occasional daydream about being the one person with medical skills for miles around after society had crumbled in some way, keeping my community healthy and maybe looking for a solution to whatever had happened. I think everyone in my class did. I'd always thought avoiding the bad guys would be the easy part. The country had so much space to get lost in. The hardest part of the whole Eternity Gene crisis had been the way society hadn't crumbled, actually. 90% of life was going on as usual, as if people, kids, weren't being snatched off the street to be harvested for the TCA strategic stockpile. In fact, it was getting harder and harder to imagine society existing without that function. Thankfully, the clinic was part of a larger specialty medical complex set against the edge of the forest, so we could stay hidden most of the way there. At most, 5 or 6 other people might pass through the parking structure each day for dermatology or colorectal appointments. I undid the improvised puzzle latch I'd fixed to the side of the door and let us in. Dr. Hughes, I introduced myself as I reached out through the broken window to relatch it. I immediately felt pretentious using a proper title in an illegal research lab with a crying new TCA refugee. Aoife, I amended. Asher, the boy croaked his name. Well, I said, acutely feeling the inadequacy of my bedside manner, which had never been sparkling even before the crisis. Make yourself at home? There are a few empty exam rooms with padded tables. You could do worse for a bed until we figure out the long term. I carried the groceries to my lab, hoping Asher would go get himself settled and give me a moment to think, but he followed along behind me. He watched silently as I stuffed the bags into the single fridge I used for both food and samples, and then switched on the monitor to check on the last test I'd left running. The result showed more or less the same thing as every test I'd run before. The same several dozen different proteins that might or might not have anything to do with the so-called Eternity Gene effect. I kept reviewing code anyway until Asher decided to speak. You're working to disprove the TCA's theories, aren't you? He said. What makes you say that? I asked. Well, you're a geneticist, he said. And a carrier. With a secret lab. And you really don't like those guys. That was all true enough. So are you? He asked. Trying? No, I answered. The theories are true. Without intervention, genetic illnesses will begin arising in the half of the population that doesn't carry the Eternity gene, potentially contributing to hundreds of thousands of miscarriages, infertility cases, maybe even deaths per year, starting in about 2 to 4 generations' time. Oh, said Asher, and I shuddered at the multiplied echo of my own disappointment when I'd confirmed this for myself. I hoped that the TCA was just about loaded, manipulative, oversimplified junk science, I said.
They are. Asher shrugged. Even so, in that case... He rushed to say something before he could stop himself. Look, it's not that I want to go with them, believe me. But I don't want anyone else paying my dues for me. I don't want the only reason I have a life to be because I lucked out and got away. That's not... I'm not judging you. I mean, you have skills. I'm sure the world is better off with you free and doing whatever you're doing, but me... If they really do need donors, maybe the best thing I can do is... Don't, I said, maybe too sharply. Asher startled and shrank further back into his hood. Don't fool yourself. Don't let them get to you. And if you can't help letting them, don't fucking ask me to listen to it. I put my hands down on my desk and watched them shake. I thought I'd developed a thicker shell for this, but maybe I'd gone soft in my 2 years of communicating only with fellow rebels, or in this past 6 months I'd spent alone with my thoughts after the last of my assistants had disappeared on a supply run. Or maybe the protective calluses chafed into my mental skin had only compromised its structural integrity over time, tearing and leaving holes behind like knots in wood. After a few breaths, I turned my head just enough to see that Asher was still there, small and alone in the doorway behind me. I have friends in about 7 different fields, I explained, who could tell you about things that are going to kill your generation's grandchildren, kill them conscious and suffering by the hundreds of millions per year. I found myself unusually aware of how small and alone I was in that lab big enough for a team of 12. Or at least, I did have those friends, I corrected myself. And they did tell. They told everyone they could think of. But those same people who think you owe it to them to spend the rest of a short, painful life in a medical cell as living factory equipment to stockpile medication for the descendants they might never have? They've never showed a shred of interest in any of those things. Go figure, right? Asher nodded. I couldn't tell if he was placating me or honestly trying to take in whatever cold, dubious reassurance he could from this. He took another step into the lab, apparently deciding not to turn himself in just this minute, and busied himself looking at one of the microscopes. So what are you trying to do? He asked. I looked back at the code on my screen, losing my enthusiasm for combing through it for more of what I already knew. Trying to find the damn gene, I said. What do you mean, find it? Asher asked. I reached for the words to explain the project to someone other than my dead friends. The Eternity gene isn't really a single gene, I started. Attached earlobes, dimples, all the markers associated with it are controlled by dozens of separate genes. But for some reason, certain combinations reliably produce the stabilizing effect that's dying out in the other half of the population. If I can identify the specific protein formations that prevent genetic deterioration in Eternity gene carriers, I can synthesize them. Design a medication that doesn't rely on donors. So they'll stop wanting to hunt us, Asher said with sudden brightness, looking up and letting his hood slip back. Of course not, I said, and immediately regretted crushing that first hint of a smile I'd seen out of him. I hadn't brought the poor kid here for a lecture. What the hell had the TCA and their privateers done to me that I had nothing to offer him but a stagnant backlog of rage? All the same, it seemed important that he understand, that he know what to expect. I sighed and said, most of the people who want us dead or locked up right now are never, ever going to forgive us, no matter what we do. For donation dodging, Asher said heavily. For being necessary, I said. One of his eyebrows lifted slightly, uncomprehending. Ask your mother, I said. Just trust me. We can save all the lives they claim to care about single-handedly, and because it's us doing it, it will only make them hate us more. What a cure will do is punch a hole in their pretenses. They rely on the support of people who can actually be convinced that they're acting for the greater good. Without that, they'll lose their backing to hunt us for money in broad daylight. I think that's worth fighting for. Asher's smile returned, sadder and more restrained than the one before, but determined. and it did indeed reveal a dimple in his left cheek.
"That's what you meant when you said I could see my mom again?" he asked.
"Sorry it's not exactly a firm date," I said.
"I was afraid it wasn't even a plan," he said, looking around the lab a bit more purposefully. "So, what's involved? What's in the way, and how can I help?"
I almost didn't answer him. It felt like too much. After what he'd just lost, what I'd already piled onto him. But telling him there was nothing he could do felt worse.
"I've been working with samples taken from myself and from people who used to work with me here. Between us, we only had 5 of the 6 known markers. If I could take a closer look at the role the 6th one plays, it would help."
"Which one are you missing?" Asher asked, almost excited.
I pulled back my left sleeve, touched my thumb to my pinky, and lifted my hand slightly to show the peak formed by my palmaris longus.
"Missing wrist tendons," I answered.
Asher unhooked his sleeve from his thumb and mirrored my gesture. His inner wrist remained flat.
"How much blood do you need?" he asked, and grinned.
That flat patch of skin brought back a flare of the confidence that had leaked out of this project so slowly that I'd barely recognized its absence. As I welcomed it back, I had to swear to myself that this wasn't part of the math I was doing when I decided to run those people over. It worked. In theory, at least. With Asher's blood under the microscope next to mine and my old friend's, it took me 2 days to do what I'd spent 2 years attempting. I went from examining hundreds of proteins to zeroing in on the curious similarities between just 5. If I'd thought things through, I would have found a cautious way to update Asher on my progress. But he had taken to sitting in my lab while I worked, reading the school books he'd had in his backpack when I'd picked him up, and occasionally bringing me instant coffee in exchange for a 5-minute crash course on whatever I happened to be doing at that moment. Once I let slip that first triumphant whoop, I couldn't take it back.
"You got it?" he gasped, setting down his geometry book and bounding over, as if he was expecting my screen to start flashing with fireworks and the word "cure" in giant letters.
"Slow down," I said, before he could get his heart set on telling his mom to expect him home for dinner. "Don't throw away your wrist warmers just yet."
"But that was the sound of a breakthrough, right?" he said.
Yeah, I admitted. I think I found essentially the recipe."
"That's awesome," he said, bouncing onto his tiptoes. "So now we whip up a test batch, right?"
"Yes," I said. "But to do that, we're going to need a bioreactor, a chamber for growing biologically active cultures under controlled conditions."
"And you don't have one," Asher extrapolated from my tone. I drummed my fingers on the desk to help me think, and to let Asher know I was working on it. I'd known that if I succeeded, this step would come sooner or later, but I'd told myself it was best not to put the effort into bringing a heavy new piece of machinery into the lab before I was ready to use it, because of the risk of being found out and having to run and abandon everything but my emergency bag at any moment. Really, I'd been hoping that, by now, I'd have a less complicated lead on where to get one.
"I have a friend who might have one to spare," I said.
"Great," said Asher. "Where's your friend?"
"Other side of the city," I said. Normally I would have waited to put fresh plates on my car before a drive that long, but my DMV connection had been dead for months now. I didn't have a way to make this any safer than it would be that night. Or maybe I was just impatient for the next step. Apart from needing to pull over once so that Asher could put his head between his knees and wait for a fit of car sickness to pass, the drive stayed easy and quiet as far as the old industry district where Dr. Kimya Hashemi had been running her operation as of 18 months ago. I parked in the little complex full of rundown fast food restaurants, and we hurried around the side of one of the abandoned office buildings to its fire stair exit. Holding my breath, I grabbed the handle and pulled. The latch was still jammed open from the inside, maybe even with the same playing card as the last time I'd been here, so the door swung free with only a little effort. I motioned for Asher to stand clear and pulled on the cord hanging just inside, listening for the familiar clang of the bell 2 stories up.
If there was anyone left to hear it, they'd be here soon to help us past all the traps and alarm systems waiting just a little farther inside. A minute might have passed, or 20. The tension made them feel identical. Then came the click of someone unlatching the shotgun trap that must still have been on the fire stairs' second landing. "What do you want?" an unfamiliar woman's voice shouted from the shadows there. "I'm a friend of Dr. Hashemi," I answered. I could feel the woman assessing me from her more advantageous position. Would she say the same? She might not use the word friend, I admitted, but she knows I'm no privateer. Stay there, the woman ordered. After another minute, or 20, the woman returned and waved for us, now visible to my better adjusted eyes. The route she chose took us through one of the building's long common rooms that had once held cubicles. At least a dozen children now played on the thinly carpeted floor with blocks and dolls and coloring books, while a handful of adults sleepily watched a movie on a cracked smart board against the wall. Three teenagers were gathered around a single handheld video game system, and they eyed Asher curiously as we entered. I recognized the couch they were sharing as one I'd once helped carry up those same fire stairs. There hadn't been nearly so many people to seat then. "You can wait here," the woman told Asher. Asher looked to me reluctantly. "Might be best," I told him. "There's history." I walked with him toward the older kid's side of the room. "I thought your friend ran another lab," Asher whispered to me. "Parts of the building used to belong to a medical supply company and pharmaceutical startup," I explained, "before it was all bought out and shuttered. Their discoveries and some of the staff were absorbed into one of the big guys, but most of the equipment was left behind." "Why didn't you tell me?" he asked. "That we were going to a refugee camp?" I tried to help him with naming the place. "Underground community? Resistance cell?" "I didn't want to get your hopes up," I answered. "My hopes for... oh," said Asher, looking at the couch, the promise of company close to his own age. "By next election cycle, you'll get me back to my own friends and family," he said resolutely. "Until then, I'm not leaving you without a lab assistant." I tried to hide my relief, to look indifferent to the thought of going back to hunting the cure completely alone. If he changed his mind, I didn't want him to feel guilty saying so. "Okay then, assistant," I said, and handed him my bag, half-joking, half-promising to return for it. The woman led me onward and finally ushered me into one of the executive offices, where I'd visited Kimya so often in the early days of the crisis, to coordinate our efforts or just to talk. It was more cluttered now than it had been in those days. Floor laid with cots, walls lined with boxes full of bandages and pills and sample packaging. Clearly her center of operations as the building's community doctor. Seated on top of, rather than behind, the wide main desk, Dr. Kimya Hashemi herself looked to have aged about 5 times the normal rate, but she was otherwise just as I remembered her. Same intense eyes, same bobbing feet that could never stay still. Same hijab pulled low over her hairline in what was now perhaps the single most dangerous look to wear on the street. Riskier than Asher's floppy bangs and thumb-length hoodie. Riskier even than a string bikini and shaved head with all 6 markers hiding in plain sight. She appraised me impassively for several seconds before sliding off the desk and wrapping me in a violent hug. "Tell me you're here to join us," she said in my ear, still holding me firmly to her. "Tell me you came to enroll that kid you brought. We have a school now. We've got kids who had to drop out to avoid the privateers getting an education in spite of it all. Tell me we're going to keep this place alive together." I didn't tell her that. "Forget what you came to say," she hissed, "and say that instead." When I still didn't speak, she squeezed me once more, let go, and shoved me to arm's length. "Fine," she said. "Why are you here?" I took her invitation to get to the point. "I need the bioreactor," I said, "from the storage room." Kimia's eyes stayed fixed on me, but her expression closed. "What for?" she asked. She knew, but she was going to make me say it. "I am so close to a cure," I said. She turned away and groaned as if she wished she could put the words back in my mouth. "I am," I said. "I can show you the data."
"Oh, I never said you couldn't do it," said Kimya. "I just can't believe you really wasted the past 2 years trying to help the same people who are trying to kill us."
"You know they're not the ones I'm doing it for," I said.
"You think that?" Kimya turned and raised her finger at me. "They always make us think that. Whatever we do, we're not doing it for them, we're doing it to save ourselves, or whoever else they're holding a gun to until they get what they want. But in the end, who ends up benefiting from our work?"
"If we don't do it, who ends up suffering?" I countered.
"Those people out there are willing to enslave billions," she turned her accusing finger to the blacked-out window, "just so that not one of their grandsons will face the indignity of having to go up to his neighbor with the dimples and ask her for help making him a father, knowing that no matter how nicely he asks, she might say no. And your solution is to tell them, 'No worries, never mind, I'll fix it so he won't have to ask after all.'"
"If we can do that without so much as inconveniencing that dimpled neighbor," I said, "what's the harm?"
"This is not the first time," said Kimya. "And it won't be the last. The Tomorrow's Children Authority is just the latest name, the latest face for this thing that finds legitimacy over and over and raises its mobs and sweeps through the population. Do you think I've forgotten?" I snapped at her.
"Yes," she snapped back.
"If you remembered, really remembered, you'd at least be considering it."
"Considering what?" I asked.
"That maybe they should die out." The thought hit me harder than I expected it to, with both its unthinkability and its ever-presence, in so many of our conversations before we went our separate ways,
and in my own mind every day since.
"They're just genes," I presented the reasoning I realized I'd had ready for this moment. "Cruelty isn't genetic. Or if it is, it's only partially, and in a much more complex way than we understand. Earlobes, knees, none of it can be used as an indicator of morality."
"No, but the way people wield what they get is an indicator," said Kimya.
"The non-carriers who hit us, even the ones who just left us alone, you know as well as I do that they won't have any real trouble finding willing help when they need it. And the ones who hunted us? Maybe we're due for a generation that wasn't raised by them." I closed my eyes, trying not to picture the difference such a large-scale change in nurture might make in just a few generations. There was a forbidden scope to the idea. I could have justified staying with Kimya in the beginning, shifting away from research and focusing on direct care. But I couldn't back down now, after what I'd found. It would be playing God by inaction. Besides,
"It won't happen that way," I said.
"They will use the gene however they want, with or without our bodies attached to it. We don't have the leverage to stop them."
"You're wrong," said Kimya.
"The cost is too high if I'm not," I said. Seconds passed. Neither of us spoke. Neither of us looked away. "Fine. Take the confounded bioreactor," Kimya sighed. "I hope it gives you what you're hoping for." Before I could find words adequate to thank her, the lights in the executive office went out all at once with a buzzing tone.
"Anything to worry about?" I asked, hoping the question would turn out to be a joke.
"It's just the alarm for privateers," said Kimya, going to the window and peeling back part of the black poster board taped to the inside to look out. "They'll search the restaurant complex down there and maybe spread out into the abandoned buildings a little bit. They might get into our first floor and admire how abandoned it is. But when everything's just as quiet as the last time, they'll get bored and move on." She trailed off, looking at something in the complex.
"You didn't drive here, did you?" she asked.
I started and never finished. My hesitation was confession enough.
"Perfect," said Kimya.
"It has dealership plates," I said sheepishly.
"Are you serious?" said Kimya.
"That barely works against cops. The privateers have been wise to it for months."
"They have?" I said, my throat suddenly dry.
Everyone knows that. What have you been doing since you left? Science? I said. Kimia breathed out through her teeth and pushed past me to the office door. I followed her. The privateers don't rely on the police database, she said. They'll just see a car they can't account for, the most suspiciously marked car you could possibly have brought, and they'll go from casually sniffing around to scouring every inch of a 2-block radius for a payday. Dara, she called out to the woman who'd escorted us in. Get the children to the roof and get everyone in position for a siege. This is not a drill. Dara's face said that these were not words heard often here, maybe never before. She started toward the common room, calling out names, probably of the children. Asher, I called out in kind, panic and guilt rising to my vocal cords. Asher! He left. One of the girls who'd been playing with the video game ran up to me. I was just telling him about what the alarm was and what the privateers do, and he took off. I reached for my pockets, remembered throwing everything into the bag in my rush to get in here. The bag now lay in the corner where the teens had been sitting, its flap hanging open next to Asher's backpack. I plunged my hands into the bag, knowing what I wouldn't find. He has my keys, I realized aloud to Kimia as Dara ushered the girl and her friends out of the room. He's going to try to move the car. I started toward the stairs, but Kimia grabbed my arm. You running out there screaming his name isn't going to help anyone, she said, and pulled me sideways into another office with covered windows. Peeling newspaper back from the glass in tiny sections, we looked down at the fast food complex together. It looked like the privateers had just discovered the car. All 10 or 12 of them were still clustered together near it, talking. Asher had already managed to cross the street toward them unnoticed. As we watched, Asher slipped in through the side door of a jack-in-the-box and then burst out through the front in full view of the privateers. The whole pack instantly turned their attention to him, strolling across the nearly empty lot, flaunting their lack of hurry. They'll think he's been there the whole time, Kimia whispered, a wish as much as a prediction. They'll think he's alone. They won't search. They'll tear him to pieces and hand the pieces over to be cut open, I whispered back. Kimia didn't rebuke me for pointing it out, didn't remind me of how many more kids there were inside the building. She just let me have the words, as if they were some comfort. Asher didn't pretend to ignore the privateers this time. He met them with a key-studded punch to the first face he could reach, and a kick to the stomach of the first to retaliate. Some of them hesitated after that, thrown from their mental scripts. They still outnumbered Asher, of course. But without his backpack, the confused privateer who tried to restrain him for examination grabbed him by the back of his jacket instead. Rather than try to keep himself covered, Asher slipped immediately out of his sleeves, and in that moment, he was out in front of them all, with no one between him and the car. Without looking back, he sprinted full tilt across the asphalt. He was fast. The privateers gained some ground when he fumbled with the automatic door key, but by then he had enough of a lead to get the driver's door open and slam it behind him. Privateers surrounded the car as they reached it, scraped at its paint with keys and jewelry, shoved it as if to tip it over. One of them drew a pistol and shouted for the others to get out of his way, but by then it was too late. Asher peeled out of the parking lot with all the wobbly enthusiasm of an unlicensed beginner, the bullets meant for his tires shattering against the ground behind him. He did it, I breathed, as the privateers rushed belatedly for their own cars, and Kimia let me have those words, too. It took nearly an hour for Asher to make his way back and pull the bell to be let back upstairs. It was past midnight, but no one in the building seemed to be able to sleep after the narrowly averted siege, so they sat up waiting for confirmation of his safe return. When Dara escorted him out of the fire stairwell, Kimia and I were at the front of the landing waiting for him, next to the teenagers, more than 3 of them now that they'd woken their friends, with families and assorted adults crammed in behind us. I parked farther away this time, Asher panted, getting a few giddy, exhausted laughs. I did good? He asked. You may have saved all our lives, Kimia acknowledged soberly, without adding that they might not have needed saving without us here. Asher tried to lift his arm in some kind of victory gesture, but didn't seem to have the strength to do it. I'm so sorry you had to do that, I told him. I should have known better. It's fine, said Asher, still unable to catch his breath. Everything's... Asher put a hand to his stomach, then to his chest, wincing. Everything's...
Still gasping for breath, he swayed heavily from side to side and then toppled forward, hitting the ground face first without raising a hand to break his fall.
Everyone back up, Kimia shouted. Dara, get the stretcher, bring him to my office.
Kimia and I performed the exam together, but she was the one who thought to remove Asher's sneakers almost immediately. His feet and ankles were heavily swollen, with the crisscross pattern of his shoelaces bruised into his skin. Does he have any medical conditions you know of that could explain this? Kimia asked. No, I said, which made Kimia look grimmer. But I've only known him for a few days. She touched his wrist, taking his pulse in silence. Rather than wait for her assessment, I did the same on his other side. Irregular heartbeat, I listed. Severe water retention, loss of consciousness, shortness of breath. He complained of nausea on the way here. I reached for early, never-applied lessons from school. It wouldn't be... We're not looking at renal failure. Looks like, Kimia confirmed. But he's 15, I said. He doesn't have any addictions harder than caffeine, or I'd have seen the withdrawal symptoms by now. What would cause... Kimia pushed his hair back from the older bruise on his neck, with the scab in the middle. Do you know where he got this? She asked. A privateer hit him, I answered. Cut him with the back of a ring. They poisoned him, Kimia explained with unwelcome certainty. It's the latest trend. They do it to force carriers to turn themselves in at hospitals. I swallowed a mouthful of bile. Every time I thought I was used to the depths they could sink to, I was wrong. Poisoned him with what? I wish I knew, Kimia sighed with exasperation. They vary it up to keep guerrilla medicine as hard as possible. I've had two residents hit with this one. I got some of the old dialysis equipment on the third floor running well enough to keep them alive so far, but that's all. If I knew exactly what we were dealing with, I might be able to start a more targeted treatment right when symptoms manifest, maybe even save the organs. She leaned heavily on the side of the rolling stretcher, weighed down by the elusiveness of if. When symptoms manifest, I said. Meaning now. With how much wiggle room? Kimia shrugged. Not knowing what the treatment would even be, I couldn't say. No more than a couple days. I nodded, squeezing Asher's unresponsive hand. I guess I better find that ring in a couple days, then. It was 3 a.m. when I parked my car next to the school crosswalk, where I'd seen the privateer stamp his personal death sentence into Asher's skin. I had plenty of time to think about the absurdity of what I was doing, to discuss it with the tank of nitrous oxide, the only anesthetic Kimia had been willing to part with, which now sat in my front passenger seat like some ghoulish stand-in, draped in the hooded jacket of Asher's I'd rescued from the parking lot. He'll be here, I told the tank. Most privateers keep regular hunting grounds and only expand when they run dry. His pack was just getting started on this place. But if someone else finds you before you find him, I could almost hear the tank answering. Well, I said, if they do, maybe they'll have the same poison kit for me to steal. And if they get the upper hand? If they harvest the one person in the world you know is on the verge of a cure? Look, I will stop this, I said. I'll break through the misinformation and get everyone the care they need. I'll put kids back in school and privateers back on the wrong side of the law. Just let me save one actual goddamn patient first. When the first parents started arriving just before dawn to drop their kids off on the way to work, they paid me no attention, taking me for the earliest among them. I sat there and watched, for a sign of disturbance, for a glimpse of the broad man with the ring or any of his associates. I almost didn't recognize him when he walked right past me, holding a cardboard tray of drinks from the cafe on my right. He looked so unremarkable as he brought the tray over to the van, where his friend with the hat opened the door for him from the inside. If I hadn't seen him work, I wouldn't have known him from the next person on the street. Wouldn't have known he was delivering sustenance for a day's carrier hunting.
The two of them exchanged words and a laugh. It suddenly seemed far-fetched that he would act the way I needed him to today. But I pulled on Asher's jacket anyway, looped it over my thumbs, and pulled the hood high. I stepped out of the car and walked as he had, head down, hands in pockets, fearful. There was a horrible moment of vindication when the broad man pointed at me and pushed the tray excitedly into his friend's hands. "Hey, you!" he called. I screamed and ran back toward my unlocked car as if I expected shelter there. He flung himself into the back seat after me. I grabbed the nitrous mask, pressed it to his face, and turned on the gas. He fought, but I got my foot on top of his ring hand and grabbed a thick clump of his hair, managing to keep the mask sealed in place for long enough to make him go limp. The ring was there. I could take it, search his pockets, analyze what he had on him, leave him to the care of his friends. Something inside me balked. What if what he was carrying today was different from what he'd used on Asher? I pulled his legs inside, shut the door, and climbed into the driver's seat. Rather than risk bringing him near Kimio's refugees, I brought the privateer back to my clinic, with his phone stashed in my Faraday cage box. I tied him to one of the padded exam tables before letting him come around. As soon as his eyes started to focus, I held the ring up in front of him, with its poison compartment open. "What did you fill this with?" I asked. I almost sounded calm. "It's an heirloom," he mumbled, a hazy, automatic excuse. "I didn't even know it opened." "I emptied several grams of fluid out of it while you were asleep," I said. "The injection mechanism makes it less than airtight. If the contents had been there for years, they would have dried out." The privateer was recovering fast from his weak anesthesia. He broke into a smug smile, then a full-blown laugh. "Is this supposed to scare me or something?" He gestured around the exam room with his head. "I mean, you kidnapped me. You drugged me. It's all pretty messed up, but you can't expect me to believe that some chicken shit ethics stickler is really gonna bust out the pliers and get shit done." Ethics stickler. It was a common pejorative his side used for mine, and it ruffled my feathers as it was supposed to for a moment, but I forced myself to ignore my first defensive instinct. "That's not what your friend said the other day about people like me," I pointed out softly, leaning closer to the table. "And it's not what your TCA says. They'd call me heartless. Butcher. Killer of children. If you believe one word of it, what makes you think you're safe here with me?" The privateer raised his eyebrows at me, looking surprised at the minuscule tremor that passed through his chin. I was surprised, too. "I don't remember what exactly the guy called it," he said. "Started with an O. Oral something." "Orelinine?" I asked, and saw the recognition on his face. "That's the only thing you've used in it." He nodded. "Were you aware, when you accepted Orelinine from some guy, that it causes irreversible kidney damage?" "Yeah, that's what he promised," said the privateer. "Extra strong, guaranteed to keep them tied to a hospital long term." "Did you know it can also render a person useless for bone marrow donation?" I continued. "The most important part of the harvesting procedure?" The privateer blinked, taking in what was definitely new information, deciding how to spin it. "How was I supposed to know? We're not going to be able to fix my friend's kidneys," I said flatly. "So I guess he's going to need a new one." "He's... what?" the privateer called after me as I left the room to rummage through the supply cabinet. I returned with a cooler and a disposable scalpel. "Wait," said the privateer, trying to wriggle one of his restrained hands free. This is insane!" "Is it?" I said, pulling up the side of his shirt and opening an alcohol wipe to rub him down. "Why do you feel entitled to have kidneys anyway? Two of them, no less. Two lungs, two corneas. When's the last time you had half your liver cut out? It grows back, you know." It has to be a match," the privateer protested. right? You can't just rip a kidney out of me and put it in your friend.
So? I said.
I'm sure someone needs it. And if they don't, there are research applications. Even the abstract possibility of life for someone else at some point in the future is worth giving up yours for, right?
Doctor, he started.
Have you ever even given blood, you greedy piece of shit?
I stopped him.
How many people, actual, thinking, feeling, non-theoretical people, have already died because you didn't want to make a sacrifice to save them? You're so fucking generous, aren't you? I shouted and shoved him hard enough to make the table wobble. With other people's bodies. I pulled on my surgical mask. Other people's lives. I snapped on my gloves. Well, guess what? I pulled the sterile packaging off the scalpel. You're up. The privateer was sweating and thrashing against the restraints now. I wanted him to feel what I felt. I wasn't really going to do it. Or maybe I was.
Aoife? Asher called out from the entrance, the puzzle latch clicking in his hands.
Help! The privateer screamed.
Aoife? Asher shouted louder and followed the screams into the room at a run, or as close to a run as he could get while dragging a 2-liter wheeled bioreactor behind him. He stopped in the doorway, still looking weak and panting from the exertion, with a pressure bandage over his left arm from a night's dialysis. What's going on? He asked, looking from me to the privateer, who seemed to have recognized from the bruise on Asher's neck that he didn't look much like help. Asher settled on one of the simpler details to question first.
Why are you wearing my jacket?
The scalpel slid out of my hands, and I had to hold my knees and answer him slowly, rationing my rushing breath.
What are you doing out of bed? I asked.
Doctor, he stopped short of saying Kimia's last name in front of the privateer. I mean, the doctor didn't want me to leave yet, he acknowledged.
With good reason, I said. And I have to be back for the next round by tomorrow, he said.
But I woke up, and you left. Without the bioreactor. Without me. And then I saw the news.
What news? I said.
This guy? Asher pointed at the privateer. His face is breaking news all over the place. Kidnapped in front of witnesses on a crowded street by a woman with red hair. They even described the scratches on your car. I figured I knew where you'd take him, and I know you don't use media from here, so I had to warn you. When I threatened to take public transportation, the door lady dropped me off.
Why would you do that? I said, rubbing my arms to try to make them stop shaking.
I didn't know what to do with him here, in the middle of my apparently newsworthy kidnapping situation, seeing me behave so very undoctorly.
Asher ignored the question and looked at the exposed section of the struggling privateer's side.
Finding an antidote for me not going so well? He guessed.
I'm sorry, I said.
Asher tried to shrug.
I came to tell you I don't care about that, he said, setting the bioreactor upright. I care about this. We have the data and the equipment. Can we please just get started?
I want to live to see things get better than this. At least the beginning of better.
I looked at the privateer too, trying to decide what the hell I was going to do with him so that I could say yes. I hadn't even gotten as far as arranging the transfer stretcher in my imagination when the siren sounded. Dozens of them all at once, on all sides. A declaration of having successfully and silently surrounded us. Asher must have beaten them here by a matter of minutes.
How? I muttered, checking my Faraday box for the privateer's phone, still sitting neutralized under the wire mesh. With a stab of dread, I lifted the privateer's sleeve under his restraint. The privateer's smugness made a reappearance as we both realized that, after all this time, all this effort, I was going to lose my lab to the GPS in his fucking smartwatch. A garbled threat I couldn't make out blared from a loudspeaker outside. I turned to Asher.
Maybe we can hide you, I said. If I put this guy back under for a while, no one will know to look for you.
There was a crash of breaking glass from the clinic's front windows, followed by the distinctive hiss I'd come to recognize as tear gas. So much for hiding. "Do you want to surrender?" I asked Asher. "You might end up in a real hospital if they figure out you're no use to the CCA. Then probably juvenile detention for dodging. There's a chance you'd live long enough for the tides to shift and set you free." Asher thought this over, and then shook his head, hefting the bioreactor onto his back by its single carrying strap. "Okay, then," I said. "We run. Out the back. I'll go first to the left. You wait 5 seconds and run right. Meet at the North Road." I pressed my data drive into his hand. "Why are you giving me this?" he asked. "We should keep them together," I said, touching the bioreactor. "The thing's to work on the cure." "But I don't know what to do with them," he objected, trying to pull the strap from across his chest. I held it in place until he stopped to rub his streaming eyes. The white particle cloud had made its way down the hallway and was beginning to fill the room. My throat burned more fiercely with each prickling breath. I wanted to say something about getting the materials to Kimya, even though I wasn't sure she'd be able to decipher my notes, or that she'd want to try. I tried to point out how much faster Asher was than me, and how I was the one who'd brought the police here, and that it wasn't his description they were determined to fill with a flesh-and-blood suspect. I thought of telling him that maybe it was his turn to have someone else play decoy. But I soon found the gas too thick to speak through. I took one glance back at the privateer now coughing and moaning on the table, and before I could think too much about it, I unfastened the restraint on his left wrist so that he could make his way out after us. The tear gas cloud was a little thinner by the back exit, but bad enough that Asher whimpered painfully when I gestured to remind him to scatter our escape efforts. I stepped outside with my hands in the air and walked slowly to the left. The police officers' faces were lost to me behind a filter of tears, but I could tell blurrily that the ones on this side of the clinic were pointing their weapons at me, the perfect moment for someone else to make a break for it. I counted to 5, but I didn't hear Asher rush past me. I only heard the door creak and tentative footsteps. He must still have been able to see me, or at least the shape of where I was. I broke into a run so that he would do the same. The first rubber bullet took my leg right out from under me. Another crunched against hollow metal that must have been the bioreactor on Asher's back. I thought he might have made it past the police line and into the kudzu overgrowth, but my eyes were too watery to be sure of anything. Normally, bone marrow is removed from the pelvic bone under general anesthesia, my personal TCA technician and jailer explained to me on my first day of harvesting, after strapping me into the machine. Her ponytail bobbed cheerfully as she nodded her head in time with her words. "But that requires a recovery period of nearly 3 weeks. That's why we developed this system, to allow for extraction on a weekly basis, while minimizing the use of drugs that could interfere with the other procedures." I didn't comment, and eventually she continued her spiel. "Now, I won't lie, the one downside of our system is that it will hurt. I recommend deep breaths and positivity. Just think, the life you save might alter the course of history," she said earnestly. "They might turn out to be the genius who finds the cure for cancer or Parkinson's or some other horrible disease." "Shut up and get on with it, you ridiculous traitor," I said. She touched one of her free-hanging earlobes, as if worried it might have fused itself to her face to match mine. As if that were the only connection there could possibly be between us. She closed the chamber and started the cycle. The first harpoon-like needles punctured deep into my femurs. I didn't try not to scream.
Sacrifice was written and performed by Fiona J.R. Tichenel. Narration was provided by Matt Carter. This episode was edited by Fiona J.R. Tichenel and Matt Carter. The Shadow Storyteller's theme, written and performed by Dennis Tichenel. The Shadow Storyteller's artwork by Kristen McQuiggan of Drop Dead Designs. For more information on the Shadow Storyteller's podcast and our other fiction works, please visit our website at theshadowstorytellers.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe for more information on upcoming episodes. We hope you had fun, and we'll see you again soon.